This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you think of transparency, big pharma might not be the first industry that comes to mind. Companies can take their drugs off the open market, making it harder for generic manufacturers to test their versions. And the price hike last week by Turing Pharmaceuticals showed just how confusing price regulation is in the industry. Is basic clinical information about drugs obscured too much? A recent study out in the British Medical Journal turned up new information about the popular antidepressant drug Paxil. My next guest expands on this story and other selected short subjects in science. Amy Nordstrom is a science writer for International Business Times. She joins us here in New York. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, Ira. Nice to have Thanks you. For having
First
me.
First timer.
That's right.
Let's talk about this research analyzing or reanalyzing Paxil.
Right. So traditionally, you know, when a company makes a new drug, they typically hold on to the data and keep it pretty secret. They only share it with the federal government because they have to for approval. But recently, one big company, GlaxoSmithKline, allowed a team of researchers to comb through their company's data for the antidepressant Paxil, which has been on the market since the 1990s. And this group of researchers was particularly interested in Paxil because after it was sold and prescribed to patients, some psychiatrists picked up on the fact that it might actually increase depression in some teens, and in some cases might even lead them to commit suicide or have suicidal thoughts. And in the original company's data, there were about 5 patients in a trial of 275 teens who reported this kind of behavior. But when the researchers went back and took another look, they actually found 11 patients who they said either became suicidal or engaged in self-harm while on the Paxil trial. And this made a big splash in the media and within the scientific community. And it's not actually going to change much about how Paxil is used today because since that original trial, the FDA has put a label on the drug that says it's not recommended for use in teens, and most psychiatrists have already kind of been aware of the dangers associated with it. But this study may really shake up that long tradition of drug companies holding on to their data and not really sharing it with scientists. In fact, a bunch of drug companies, including Bayer and Eli Lilly, GlaxoSmithKline, and Novartis, have since launched a new website where researchers can submit requests to access clinical trial data that they think deserves a second look.
Yeah, a little more transparency.
That's right. I mean, it could give us a lot more information about the medicines that we take, and it could lead doctors to prescribe these medicines more effectively. Certainly in teens, that population in particular tends to handle drugs differently than adults. So in some teens, things like Benadryl might even, rather than cause drowsiness, could actually cause them to feel more awake.
Interesting. Let's talk about a study that looks at snakes and leg development.
That's right. So the ability to grow legs is encoded in our DNA, the DNA of you and of me, through segments called limb enhancers. And typically with genetics and DNA, it's sort of a use it or lose it type of situation, where if you're not using a particular part, if you don't need it anymore, if you go legless like snakes did about 100 million years ago, that part of your DNA is kind of lost to random mutations and crowded over. Mm-hmm. And about 3 years ago, scientists began to sequence the very first snake genomes. And this was an exciting moment, especially for a researcher at the University of Georgia who takes a look at these limb enhancers in different animals. And he took a look at the presence of these enhancers in snake genomes and found that they did in fact exist. So snake genomes retain the ability to sprout legs, even though scientists would have assumed that this ability had long been lost. The funny thing is, when they put these limb enhancers from the snakes into mice, they didn't work quite right. And so then the question becomes, well, why did snakes retain these limb enhancers for 100 million years if they don't even really work right anymore?
Exactly what I would have been.
I thought you might, Ira. So I spoke with the researcher, and he has a theory about why the snakes might still have these parts in their DNA. And it sort of coincides with the theory that evolutionary biologists have had for a while, and that is that the same enhancers that we use for DNA might also give rise to genitals and help form genitals in animals. And this actually matches what we know about a few genetic disorders in humans that are quite rare but seem to affect both the limbs and the genitals. So now we can kind of trace that back to the genetic location, perhaps.
Who would have thunk, right? Wow. I thought maybe when they put them in mice, the mice got legs, but that's not what happened.
Not quite. The snakes are probably using them for a different purpose.
Yeah. Researchers looked at using mouse models as a type of personalized medicine. Talk about that for me.
Right. So, you know, just like two people, no two tumors are alike. And the differences between tumors can actually mean the difference between a patient who responds well to a drug and one who responds poorly, even if they have the exact same type of cancer. And researchers haven't really had a good idea of trying to figure this out. In the past, they've kind of just had to try drugs on patients and see if they work or not. That process is expensive. It can take a long time, and it's not that great for patients who have to cycle through many different drugs. So a team at Johns Hopkins decided to see if they could test drugs in mice instead of in humans, and they did this with a very clever method. They took 129 samples of tumors from patients with colorectal cancer, and they actually grafted them onto mice. And each patient had their own unique mouse model that had their personalized version of cancer grafted onto it. And then they were able to test a common drug used to treat colorectal cancer in the mice first and see which patients would respond to it before actually prescribing it to the patients. And in this trial, they found about 3/4 of the tumors responded to either that drug or a combination of other therapies. And they say that, you know, one day, this was just an early test, but one day cancer patients may have their very own mouse model that we can test drugs on before actually subjecting patients to that.
You mean they would take a tumor off of you and stick it on a mouse?
Exactly. And they would, and if it doesn't work on the mouse, then I don't need to try it. And pharmaceutical companies may also be able to use mice with these tumors grafted on to develop new treatments or to catch treatments that are more likely to fail earlier in the process, which would sort of reduce the expense of drugs.
Yeah, that's great news. Let's talk about your last story, which is about blue whales, and to help answer the question, how can whales get so big when they eat these tiny little microscopic krill? You have the answer for that.
Blue whales are the largest animal ever to be on the earth,
yeah.
Including dinosaurs. But they eat very, very small food, like you said, and they require about 1 ton of krill every single day. And for a long time, marine biologists have just assumed that whales are a lot like cows in the way that they eat, which is like cows who just graze around all day. They figured whales just swim around with their mouths kind of open and let the krill kind of come in. But researchers off the coast of California who tagged 55 blue whales found that they're much more sophisticated and efficient about this process. The whales will actually take these very deep dives called lunges into patches of krill that are particularly high quality and dense. And if they find one, they might lunge there for hours and hours and sort of fill up on a patch of krill before swimming away.
Did you say lunge or lunch?
Lunge.
Lunging for lunch. Right?
Exactly. Mm. And so this is very, very different feeding behavior than what they previously knew about blue whales. And it's important because if we know more about the way that blue whales feed, we can do a better job of protecting them. And they are an endangered species.
Wow, that was terrific, Amy. That's a great lineup of stories for us. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much.
Amy Nordstrom is a science writer at International Business Times here in New York. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And 2 years ago, we talked about something truly novel. This is a burger grown in a laboratory. And that pricey patty developed by Dutch scientists cost over $300,000. It's certainly not on the dollar menu anywhere. And when I interviewed Josh Schoenwald, a journalist who got to take a bite out of that in vitro burger, he described the flavor like this.
It tastes somewhere between not bad, okay, and decent.
Not a ringing endorsement, but someday we might all have the choice to chew on cultured meat. And joining me now to talk about the good and bad of producing meat in petri dishes and factories is Carolyn Maddock. She's a science and technology policy fellow with the AAAS in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Let's talk about the good thing about this.
Okay, well, as you said, this technology is still in the development phase, so all of this is a bit speculative. But let me start with greenhouse gas emissions. So as listeners are probably aware, cows produce methane as a byproduct of digestion, and pound for pound, methane absorbs more infrared radiation than carbon dioxide. So its impact on climate change is many times greater. So the good thing here is that cultured meat doesn't produce methane. So even cultured beef could contribute less to global warming than the beef we eat today. Mm-hmm. The second benefit is land use. So just like animals, cultured meat will require nutrients from plants in order to grow. But if we only culture the edible meat and not the inedible parts like the bones or internal organs, fewer plants will be required. So that means agricultural land could be freed up for other purposes.
That's another good thing, yeah.
And another benefit is that it could reduce the number of chickens, pigs, cows, and other animals living in confined feeding operations and, of course, being slaughtered. So overall animal welfare could improve.
So what could be bad about any of this stuff?
Okay. Well, let me start with energy. So this is hypothetical, but as it stands, making cultured meat requires a lot of energy. So think of it as being similar to the Industrial Revolution, when tractors and automobiles were burning fossil fuels and replacing horses on farms and roads. So the difference today is that rather than letting the animal's internal processes create muscle, cultured meat would use machines to accomplish the same goal. So the factories wouldn't produce methane, as I said before, but the energy that they use could be a source of carbon dioxide, which contributes to global warming as well. So as it stands now, poultry and pork production might actually have a smaller global warming impact than creating those types of meats in a factory. So this is a bit peripheral, but I mentioned before that we might culture edible meat and nothing else. But today we actually use animal byproducts in a wide variety of everyday goods. So take leather as just one example. If the supply of cowhides declines, we don't know what will take its place. We do know researchers are looking at growing cultured leather, but this will likely have good things and bad things, just like meat.
Yeah, because when you eat the meat, you get the leather. You have more than just the meat from the animal. You
that's
get the
right.
Yeah, there are other
that's
things
right.
to take away from that. Yeah,
that's right. So I'll make a final point about cost. And you said that the first proof of concept hamburger costs more than $300,000. So researchers say that the cost is steadily dropping, but it's really too soon to say where it will end up at this point.
All right. We're not holding our breath for that cultured meat. And thank you for laying out the good news and the bad news, Carolyn.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Carolyn Maddock is a Science and Technology Policy Fellow with the AAAS in Washington. We're going to take a break, and after the break, Hasher Oste Ki Dothraki. Do you speak Dothraki? We'll talk with David J. Peterson, the language creator from the Game of Thrones. He'll give us a little lesson in Dothraki. It's about all I can say. We'll say more after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Game of Thrones, you know, that popular HBO series, has all the elements of an epic sci-fi fantasy. You've got your sprawling landscape, your family kingdoms battling one another, vying for power. And one of the most detailed elements of the story is the many languages of these fictional kingdoms, like take the Dothraki, as spoken here by warlord Khal Drogo. In the program, Dothraki is a fully developed spoken language, but it didn't start out that way. Author George R.R. Martin only hinted at the Dothraki language in his original book series, and throughout the entire series, Martin included a total of just 56 Dothraki words and names. Just 56. So how do you create a complex spoken language system out of a handful of words on a multi-part TV show? Well, that's what my next guest was tasked with. David J. Peterson is a language creator who works on Game of Thrones, and he's also author of the new book, The Art of Language Invention. Mach. David, did I get that right?
Kind of. I think you meant math. Or perhaps Mathjomaroon.
What did I say and what did you say?
Okay, so math is the short form of Mathjomaroon. Mathjomaroon means technically with respect, and it actually, it's how you say hello.
Oh, Mathjomaroon. Huh? Well, it almost sounds Italian, yeah?
Oh, that's the first I've heard that.
I'm going to tell our listeners, if they have a question about how languages are created and they want to talk about it, they can call in 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. Now, as I said, David, you had 56 different Dothraki words to start with. So what's your first step to piecing this whole puzzle together to create the entire language?
Hey, so the first step was to create, I'm sorry, let me back up. The first step was, with George R. R. Martin's works, to find every single word and name that existed in the books at that time. So there were only four books, and in fact, there was only Dothraki material in the first three books. So I found every single word and every single name and wrote them down. And the first step was to figure out how they were pronounced. It was based on kind of my analysis of the spelling system, and then flesh out kind of the phonology to make sure there were no gaps or anything. And then every single place where there was a phrase, a two or longer word phrase, I had to determine what the grammar behind it was. So for example, something that I noticed is that every single time there was a word modifying a noun, the modifying word followed the noun, and it was consistent throughout the first three books. And so that gave me a clue about basically how modifiers and heads work in phrases. And it tended to, it actually remained consistent throughout all of his all of the small examples that were in the books, which was fantastic because I didn't have to do as much work or work as hard. And it consistently put the most important part of the phrase first and all of the modifiers afterwards. And so after that, I just built up from there.
And that's not uncommon in languages today to put the modifier afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then now the Dothraki language is up to 4,000 words. You had to create each of these words, the nouns, the verbs, everything. Take us through the process a little more in detail. For example, how did you create the word dream?
Right, so I needed that word. I can't remember for what script or for what reason I needed the word, but I needed it. And so the first thing I did was, dreaming is something that's common to all humans, of course, so it was kind of up to me how I wanted to produce that word. You could naturally just produce a brand new root, and that root meant to dream, but that seemed a little boring, and often it's one of those words that doesn't have a simple explanation in the world's languages. So I just reflected on my own experience of what a dream is like. And the thing that always captivates me about dreams is that while you're having them, the dream appears to be your entire reality. I mean, while you're dreaming, you have no memory of what your actual life is like. And so I decided, well, that's a productive area for an etymology. And so I started with the concept of a fake life. I didn't have a word for fake. So what I did was I actually took it as an extension of the word for wooden, something made out of wood, referring to weapons. So that's something that's obviously important in Dothraki culture. And a real weapon is one that's made out of metal. A fake weapon is one that's made out of wood. Consequently, the word for wooden was analogized to also mean fake. The word for metal was analogized to mean real. So then a fake life is a dream, or literally a wooden life. And then, of course, to dream, the verb, is to live a wooden life.
So what does that sound like in Dothraki?
So the verb is thirat athiraride. And then the noun itself is athirarido.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I know that besides just having to come up with the words, the producers wanted a harsh-sounding language. What does that mean, and how did you tackle that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because when you say that a language sounds harsh, that phrase only has any meaning with respect to some other language. So, for example, there are actually people who speak many different languages across the world who find English to be a very harsh language. And it might surprise you, it's because of all of our S's, of our S's and Z's that are all over the place. It sounds very harsh, very unpleasant to the ear, to people who speak certain languages whose phonologies are very different. Now, for knowing that I was working with English speakers and that our primary audience was going to be English speakers, at least at first, what I had to figure out was, what does harsh mean to English speakers? And it turns out it's not very surprising. Harsh to English speakers means things with some of the back consonant sounds like kh and gh and h and h, which are all fine sounds, and they occur in the world's languages, and there's nothing harsh about them. But they sound kind of harsh to the ear of English speakers. So I made sure to use plenty of kh And there's a nice, a beautiful sound, qa, which doesn't exist in English. And also, I made sure to put H in places where you don't expect to find H in English. So at the end of a syllable or at the end of the word, like the word for man in Dothraki is mahraj, and the word for sand in Dothraki is pesah, like that.
Wow. Yes, harsher languages. Khaleesi is a popular character, and she plays an important part in the story. She is the mother of dragons, of course, for those of us who do follow. You say that we're pronouncing her name wrong? Is that right?
No. In truth, and I describe this in my book in the first case study on the Dothraki language. In truth, I think I made a mistake. So Khaleesi is, of course, spelled in English K-H-A-L-E-E-S-I. Mm-hmm. Now, I held it as a tenet when I was going through all of George R. R. Martin's vocabularies to hold his spelling sacrosanct, unless I just needed to change it out for something that was more consistent. Like mm-hmm. the word Dracarys is spelled with a C in the books. I changed the C to a K just to be consistent. But, you know, that's kind of immaterial. You could spell it either way. One of my rules was that if it was spelled differently, it was pronounced differently. So since there's an E-E and then an I in Khaleesi, I determined that those things must be pronounced differently, despite the fact that we pronounce them the same in English. Consequently, the native Dothraki pronunciation that I came up with was Khaleesi, like that. Khaleesi. And so, in fact, if you were like just an English speaker and you heard that word, you probably would pronounce it Khaleesi, mm-hmm. right? But instead, of course, any English speaker is going to look at that word and say Khaleesi because the EE with us is so strongly associated with the nice E sound like that. I should have realized that at the outset and should have, in that instance only, changed George R. R. Martin's spelling to be more consistent and changed it to K-H-A-L-I-S-I.
Whatever. Rest is history. But yep. Were you also cognizant of where to put the syllable accents? Because it might be easier in English to pronounce it in one place and other languages another way.
Yeah, in fact, actually, I changed, or what I did was another way to make a language sound foreign is to be sure to put the stresses in places where English speakers don't expect them. Mm. And so Dothraki has kind of a default to left stress system where the stress will always be on the first syllable if the word ends in a vowel, or for the most part, and if the word ends in a consonant, it's always on the last syllable. One thing I've noticed about English is that we don't expect words to be stressed on the last syllable unless they're verbs or if they're foreign. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the way that we identify kind of a foreign word, especially with nouns. If nouns are stressed on the last syllable, that's very strange in English. If you think about some noun-verb pairs, we have a lot of these. Subject, a noun. Subject, a verb. And you can probably come up with others. One I always think of is pervert and pervert, but that's not the best one. But
it explains it.
I know.
The Dothraki isn't the only language in the show. You created a Valyrian as well. I want to play a clip of that language, and this comes from the A Dragon Is Not a Slave scene for you fans, where mm-hmm. Khaleesi shocks a slave trader by speaking Valyrian.
Zaldrizes buzdaris kos daor.
Raji Valire.
Nige dai neres gel mas mohentar gerio lentrot. En Valeria wepo anagar exan. Valeria munuengos nuhis issa.
Well, we could hear the word Valeria in there. How did you create Valeria? How do you differentiate now between the two?
Well, I mean, I hopefully they should sound pretty different.
But when you create it, how do you make sure that they're not, in your head getting mixed up?
Oh yeah, no. For some reason, I've never had that problem. Even with learning languages, I don't know. It's like each language has its own little space in my brain, and even if I'm not as good with one as the other, I've never really mixed them up. And to my head, Valyrian and Dothraki are so radically different, both grammatically and in sound and in where they're typically used, that I've never had that problem. I did want to mention something about this scene, though. Emilia Clarke is just gangbusters. And I'll tell you why. So if you hear her speaking Dothraki in the first two scenes, I'm sorry, in the first two seasons, you'll notice that she doesn't sound like, for example, Drogo or some of the other ones. It's because she's not native. And so she's intentionally pronouncing it the way a non-native speaker would pronounce it. And in fact, in the first couple episodes, she makes some intentional, on my part, grammatical errors in Dothraki that a second language speaker would. Now, in season three, she had to become this person who was a native speaker of High Valyrian, so she was a little bit nervous about that. Because, you know, you can be a non-native speaker, that's fine. And I was so astounded by her command of High Valyrian when I heard it that, honestly, it changed the way that I pronounced it myself. I often imitate the way she does it because it was so outstanding, and I was so just pleased and tickled to death when I heard it, that it blew me away.
Wow. We're talking with David J. Peterson, a language creator who works on Game of Thrones, and he's also author of the new book, The Art of a Language Invention, a really good book for people who want to invent their own languages and get into it, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Going back to this point you made, are there people who listen to the show so carefully that they could pick up on, oh, her accent is wrong? Is there something wrong there? Or they noticed that she was speaking a foreign language?
Oh, yeah. No. Especially, with an initial viewing, it's very difficult to tell what's going on. But, I mean, come on, a show like Game of Thrones, if you like the show, you love the show. You watch every single episode dozens of times, except for maybe the one with the red wedding. So, I mean,
That's once is enough.
Yeah, it was enough for me. But, so the fans, there have been fan sites that have been taking down the languages ever since season one. Mm-hmm. And people that have gotten pretty good with it. In fact, there are a couple, I mean, not a ton, but there are a couple of people that are so good that they can actually watch a first airing now that has some Valyrian in it and tell exactly what's going on.
They taught themselves the language?
Oh, yeah. They have a better, they're more fluent in it than I am. It's amazing.
Let's go to the phones. Our number, 844-724-8255. Our first caller is Nicholas at Silver Spring, who asks the question, I'm sure that is on the mind of just about everybody. Let's see if I can get that one in here. Oh, let's go to George in Burlington. Hi, George. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira.
Hey there.
How are you? I wanted to raise, I'm not really a big Game of Thrones person, but I'm a huge Star Trek person. And hearkening back to the days when they created versions of Klingon and Vulcan on the Star Trek series and in the movies, has anything along the similar lines been done there to create a real version of those languages? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks.
I hope I understood the question right. Does he mean a real version of Klingon and Vulcan?
Yeah.
The Klingon language is a full language now, and it was developed by Mark Okren. The initial bit of Klingon was just kind of made up on the fly by James Doohan. I'm sorry, did I get his first name right? Scotty. He created the initial bits of Klingon, and Mark Okrand used that when he created the full Klingon language. So now that's fully developed. Vulcan, I think, was actually developed by the fans, not somebody working on the show. And I think it's pretty complete. I've never looked into it myself. But also, just in case there was a misunderstanding and he was talking about my languages, yes, they're all full languages. I created them.
Are those languages, the ones from Star Trek, the model languages that everybody compares any other language to, since it was such a popular show?
Perhaps fans, but not language creators. Language creation is a very old art. It goes back to the 12th century that we know of. It probably went back even earlier, but those are the earliest records we have from Hildegard von Bingen from the 12th century. So nowadays, in the early 90s, a language creation community formed online where different language creators from all over the world got together and started to share their work and learn from each other. So honestly, when we talk about comparing languages and, looking at the ones that are the best, It's often the language is created by people in the community, like, you know, Aman Yar, created by David Bell, Okuna, developed by Matt Pearson, Dirk Elzinga's Tepa, Sylvia Sotomayor's Kaylin. These are some of the languages that we kind of hold in esteem and compare our work to.
Huh. Interesting. It's quite fascinating, the whole idea of language creation. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to talk more about language creation with David J. Peterson, who's going to tell us more about Dothraki and all kinds of languages that he's working on. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us. Yes, tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
Citizens of Westeros and beyond, do you wish you could use Dothraki in your daily life? Have you mastered how to ask your fellow blood rider to take the oath to live and die as blood of my blood? Maybe you're already comfortable with simple Dothraki taunts and curses. Now, with everyday Dothraki language tapes, you'll learn simple phrases that will help you navigate Essos culture and customs. Phrases like, do you know where the bathroom is? Excuse me, is this fish fresh? I would like a glass of water, please. I prefer blue flowers to pink ones. Does your sister speak
Dothraki?
From the makers of the Direwolf Obedience Training Series, everyday Dothraki will have you speaking the language of the Horse Lords in no time. Dothraki language course is not available for sale. To hear more, listen to the Science Friday interview with David J. Peterson, author of The Art of Language Invention. Science Friday assumes no liability if your horses are stolen, your village is sacked, dragons turn your farmland to ash, or something else bad happens as a result of this course. That's on Science Friday from PRI.
I hope you enjoyed Everyday Dothraki language tapes. They are not for sale. This was just a cute little thing we put together with our own Jennifer Kwok and David J. Peterson, who's our guest. He's author of the new book, The Art of Language Invention. Good commercial, David? Like that?
Oh, yeah. Also, I'd like to note, though, if I have an old book that came out last year, Living Language Dothraki. It is an actual course if you wanted to learn Dothraki. It's there and available for purchase.
You anticipated every whim that our listeners have. And in fact, you created a language called Verbis Diablo for the show Penny Dreadful. Verbis Diablo,
yeah,
as you can tell from the name, is the language of a demon. I want to play a tiny clip of that. Boy, that sounds sinister. How did you create that one?
Yeah, so often when I'm creating a language, I'm creating a naturalistic language, one that looks like, you know, one that you wouldn't be surprised to find on Earth. That one was quite different. So for the second season of Penny Dreadful, which is, God, amazing show, they essentially wanted a language that the witches would speak to one another, one that they would just know inherently. And this language was supposed to be really, really crazy. Basically, it would be something that if you didn't have the mark of the devil, you wouldn't be able to speak it without going mad.
Hmm.
So, yeah, that was a bit of a different task from what I'm usually asked to do. So what I did there was first I worked with the languages that are already existing on the planet, because the language itself was supposed to be a corruption of human language. And I would do things like, for example, take a word from Latin and reverse it phonetically and have it mean the opposite of what it meant in Latin. I would take half of a root, say, from Middle Egyptian and half of a root from Greek, reverse those and maybe speak them with ingressive air. That is, instead of breathing out to talk, you'd breathe in to talk like that.
Wow.
Kind of
you
tough
okay?
to do. Yeah, I got it. But anyway, so it was kind of like I did kind of kooky things like that. And also, anytime there looked like there was a rule you could figure out, I would change it in another sentence, you know, because that's yeah. something that a really crazy non-language language would do.
Ever think about trying to preserve some ancient languages that very few people do speak and maybe then keep them going a little longer? No one's going to recognize them. As for your characters, you know, bring them in.
You mean in an actual show?
Yeah.
So use a native people's language as the language of the devil?
Well, I don't mean language of the devil, but if you need to create a language for a new culture or a society, just bring that one in, and then people will learn to speak it and maybe preserve it.
I don't think that would be appropriate necessarily. First, it's one thing if you're going to ask permission from the people who speak the language, and I'm not sure if they would all give permission for that. I think it's something you should do if you're going to take their language and pretend that it's, you know, the language of some aliens or something. And second, it's there is a problematic bit, which, of course, working for a television show, there are always deadlines. And if it's not done, then, you know, it's not done. And they'll just try to make something work. If you're using, for example, let's say a language from Mexico, like the Ayapaneco language, which has two speakers, it might not have all of the words that you need to talk about, you know, like alien concepts or advanced concepts or new concepts or whatever. And so at that point, you're left in a quandary. What do you do? Do you borrow in a word from English, which would kind of defy the whole purpose of having the language there? Do you try to make a word out of some of the stems from this native language, which I don't know how I'd feel about that, especially if it wasn't a native speaker doing that. Or, you know, worse, do you create something that sounds like it belongs in that language and just pretend that that's a word of the language? I don't know. To me, it feels... Yeah. That feels a little morally, I don't know, it makes me feel uncomfortable, so I don't know if I would do it. But, you know, perhaps there would be the right project that could do it. Honestly, you know, one thing that I would love for there to be is a show that is, not a fantasy or sci-fi show, but a real show that maybe talks about, you know, some of the histories or myths from some of these native cultures, and then when they do it, actually use that language to put on the show. I mean, there's a wealth of stories in the world, and I think that they deserve to be told, and I think it'd be great.
Yeah, I hope some people are scribbling these ideas now and getting them ready to go and get on. Who knows where they'll show up. Thank you, David. Fascinating book. David J. Peterson is a language creator, author of the book The Art of Language Invention, and you can read an excerpt from his book and practice your Dothraki also by going to our website at sciencefriday.com, Inventing Language. Thank you, David.
Thank you for having me.
When it comes to political issues, Latino voters in the U.S. are usually seen as one-issue voters, and that issue is immigration. But politicians are leaving out a topic of major concern to Latino voters, and that is climate change. What, you've never heard that global warming is a big issue for Hispanics? Well, then listen to this. According to a survey from August, 74% of Latinos, 74% think the U.S. government should set national standards to prevent global warming and climate change. That poll was conducted by the polling firm Latino Decisions. You're not convinced yet? Well, how about another poll completed by the New York Times and Stanford University earlier this year? It found that 54% of Latinos rated global warming as extremely or very important to them personally versus 37% of white respondents. In fact, 8 in 10 of those surveyed by Latino Decisions said they had already experienced climate change, like heat waves, intense storms, yet most said they had never been contacted by an environmental organization before. Nicole Hernandez-Hammer is working to change that. She is the Southeast Climate Advocate for the Union of Concerned Scientists, and she's been working with Latino communities in South Florida, elsewhere, on issues related to climate change. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey there. When you started working on climate change, did you see environmental organizations or government agencies reaching out to Latino communities in Florida?
You know, not so much when I started, but I would say over the past 5 years, we've seen a lot of action on climate change. The organization I'm affiliated with, UCS, is working hard to reach out to Latinos organizations like WWF, Voces Verdes, Sashamama. There are a lot of groups now. So it's a really exciting time to be working in this field.
Is it not obvious where many Latinos live, like in South Florida, that flooding they see coming from the oceans when there's a high tide like there was last week? I saw pictures of Florida, part of Florida, about Miami, underwater. Isn't that obvious that the sea level is rising due to global warming, that there is climate change going on?
Absolutely. And I think that's reflected in some of the poll numbers that you mentioned before. Latinos live in areas that are vulnerable to climate change. In fact, if you look at the Latino population, 49% of us live in coastal shoreline counties compared to 39% of the general population. So we are starting to see the impacts, and we are starting to see them in our communities.
So Latinos might have to deal with more fallout from global warming, like sea level rise, than other Americans do.
That's right. Yeah. We are more vulnerable. And if you look at the states that are most vulnerable to climate change and you compare that to the U.S. Census data, the lists are almost identical. So Florida, California, Texas, New York, and North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Is this being lost on the politicians who never think about, you know, endorsing climate change or thinking that it's really happening, that they're now, you know, and that they're not in step with most of the Latino voters?
Yeah, I think they're starting to recognize that and starting to change their approach. Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo and Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton are starting to talk about climate change and starting to talk about addressing sea level rise in South Florida. So that's encouraging news that we're starting to move in the right direction, but there's still too many politicians that haven't gotten on board just yet. And climate change isn't a problem that's going to happen in the future. It's happening now, so that needs to happen quickly.
Is it happening now across all socioeconomic Latino voters, or just some more than others?
No, it's happening across the spectrum. In Miami, we have billion-dollar condos right on the beach, and then we have low-income communities further inland, and both are seeing the effects of saltwater intrusion and sea level rise.
You know, because when I was looking at the pictures from the Miami Herald, there was some great pictures in there, and when I was looking for those pictures. You see saltwater, when saltwater comes into your neighborhood, and it comes in, and that one was about the big full moon we had last week. Once it gets there, it does incredible damage, saltwater does. And to have repeated, you know, tides overflowing the streets is really something that is not just devastating, but very expensive.
It is very expensive. There's flooding that goes into homes, and once the flooding recedes, the moisture that's inside some of the homes creates mold and affects people with asthma and other respiratory issues. Also, when the flooding happens, we have a series of canals throughout the county, and it's sometimes hard to tell the difference between the roads and the canals. And sometimes people drive right into the canals during flooding events. Mm-hmm. So there's a series of things that happen because of the inundation. In fact, some car companies no longer honor the warranty on the cars because of saltwater damage.
No kidding. Talking with Nicole Hernandez-Hammer, she's the Southeast Climate Advocate for the Union of Concerned Scientists on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Would that also be spreading possibly to not just car companies, not car insurance places, but what about homes? I mean, if you constantly get inundated with, you know, salt water.
That happens now. There are some folks that are paying more on the insurance on their homes than they are on the actual mortgage. Mm-hmm. So the rates continue to go up. But because there are subsidies that help some folks continue to develop in the areas, we haven't seen the greatest impact of that yet. But certainly the trend is towards higher rates for most people that live in coastal communities.
How did your own experience living through Hurricane Andrew as a kid influence your interest in climate change?
I think that understanding the power of nature and how it can completely change your life. We moved to a different town. I went to a different school. I was a teenager at the time. And my whole world changed. And we were in the house when it was destroyed. And we lost everything. We just came out with our lives. And so knowing that in the future, we're going to get less storms, but they're going to be more intense. And knowing how much the population has grown in Miami-Dade counties, like it has in many other coastal communities across the country, you begin to think about what people are going to be dealing with in the future. And it's not just a one-time kind of event when you're dealing with sea level rise. Mm-hmm. That kind of inundation is the new normal. And the infrastructure that we have now was built for a time that we're no longer in. So we are not adequately prepared in the county to deal with this new normal.
So how do you get this? We're certainly in an election season on all fronts, Congress, presidential. How do you get this as part of the discussion among political parties?
That's a great question. Something I did over the summer is I went up with a group of moms that live mostly in low-income communities that are vulnerable to sea level rise in Miami-Dade County. And we spoke with the staff of Rubio and Nelson and shared our stories and the issues that we're having and our concerns for the future. And we're hoping that begins to change their minds about the issue. Mm-hmm. So we're doing our best to communicate, both in terms of science, but in terms of real stories, because I think ultimately you can show someone all the graphs and charts you'd like, but when you're standing in a full foot of salt water on a sunny day and the water's going into your home, there is no room for doubt or for a fabricated discussion on climate change. You know it's real.
Yeah, that certainly is. Thank you for taking time out to be with us today, Nicole.
Thank you so much.
Nicole Hernandez-Hammer, she is the Southeast Climate Advocate for the Union of Concerned Scientists. One last thing before we go. If you go to bed late, like I do, that might explain why you gain weight. UC Berkeley researchers found in a 5-year study that adults and teens who have late bedtimes on weeknights gained weight no matter the amount of exercise, sleep time, or screen time. And that would certainly explain my additional pounds, not to mention the midnight snacks, which were not mentioned in the survey. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim, our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Our production assistant is Becky Fogel. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman is our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you missed any part of the program, you'd like to hear it again, point your tablet or your smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com, and where you can also join our mailing list. We also have our cute Dothraki language stuff up there on our website today, and photos from this incredible pictures in Florida about the flooding that were taken by Miami Herald photographer Emily Michaud, showing the flooding in the streets from just last week's full moon. It's quite eye-opening. You also, if you like us on Facebook, and you can join a week-long discussion. We're always here for you on Twitter at SciFry. We're doing Instagram, and every once in a while, we'll pop up with something surprising. And you can download our iPhone and Android apps and listen and look on demand. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.